I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Judy Cohen. She is executive producer of the documentary Bag It, which will be screened tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Farmers Market Pavilion. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So this is a really great documentary, which is narrated by, and you see throughout the movie, this guy, a self-described kind of ordinary dude, Jeb Barrier, who starts out asking some basic questions about plastic bags. How did this whole thing get made into a film?
Well, the film started with an idea that we had to create a short film about a plastic bag challenge between our town, Telluride, Colorado, and Aspen, Colorado. And so the first idea, we were just going to film that, the challenge, and it was going to be maybe a, you know, 10 or 15-minute film. We did a few interviews, and we had interviewed a scientist from Missouri who was very much involved in the health of plastic. And after that first interview, we looked at each other and we said, this is going to be a much bigger film. It's going to be a lot bigger than just plastic bags. And so that's kind of when we went on this much larger investigation into not just plastic bags, but into all kinds of plastic.
There are so many problems with plastic and with plastic bags that one barely knows where to begin. But let's talk about, for example, and probably some of our listeners already know this, but let's talk about the oceans. There's this huge part of the Pacific Ocean, which is basically covered in plastic. Is that correct? What does it look like? What is it like out there?
Well, it's the Northwest Pacific Gyre, and it is, you know, off the coast of Hawaii. And it's an area in the ocean where the current is sort of dead. And so currents come up, and they transport a lot of refuse that's in the ocean up to this one sort of dead zone. And it's a huge, huge site where there's just floating plastic. It's more like a plastic soup. It's not like you can just step off a boat and you're walking on, you know, sort of like a mass of plastic. It's more like a plastic soup that if you were to take, you know, a large container and fill it with the water from that, you would see little pieces of plastic floating around. You know, some of them are really minuscule, but then you'll also see, like, maybe, you know, larger pieces that are starting to degrade and decompose into smaller pieces of plastic.
And I think that's the point, is that they don't really decompose. I mean, they don't biodegrade. They just turn into smaller pieces of plastic, which has really serious consequences for marine life and bird life and all ocean life in that area.
Yeah, what happens is that the plastic, what it's called is it photodegrades. And that's a word that's used to describe how plastic just breaks up into really little pieces. And fish see that, and marine mammals see that, and they think that it's krill or it's another small fish that they're eating, when actually what they're eating is very little small pieces of plastic. And they've measured the amount of plastic in the Northwest Pacific Gyre, and the ratio of plankton to plastic has really decreased. In fact, there's more plastic than plankton in the Northwest Pacific Gyre. So fish are actually eating more plastic than they are eating food, and it's become a really, really serious problem. There's more than one gyre in the ocean. They've sort of designated five different areas where the currents have sort of stopped, and there's not as much movement, and there's five different gyres all over the earth at this point.
And in those places, these creatures think that they're eating, but they're actually not really eating. They're not eating food that has any nutrition. They're eating plastic. What happens to them?
Well, in the case of the Laysan albatross, which is a bird that nests on Midway Atoll out in the Pacific, it flies up to the Northwest Pacific Gyre, and the mother birds scoop up a bunch of plastic in their beak, and then they fly back down and regurgitate it to their young on the island. And instead of regurgitating food, which normally is what they would be doing, they are feeding the little chicks pieces of plastic. And what happens is the chicks obviously are getting malnourished because they're eating plastic instead of food. And then it also clogs their whole digestive system. And there have been just hundreds and thousands of birds and other marine animals dying because they're not, either A, they're not getting enough to eat, or B, their whole digestive system is becoming clogged with plastic. And this, we've seen this both in birds and in sea turtles. Sea turtles, they eat jellyfish, and what looks like a jellyfish in the water is a plastic bag. So they're finding that in the stomachs of sea turtles that have died, they're finding just lots and lots of plastic bags and other kinds of plastic that they're unable to pass.
It's so sad. I mean, all the things that human beings do to themselves is one thing, but then what human beings do to all of these other creatures who really have nothing to do with us. They're wild animals. In a lot of cases, we don't eat them. And we're killing them in these horrifying ways. I don't know. I mean, watching your and other documentaries on this subject, it touches one's heart in a way that's hard to describe, but it's like, it just seems so horribly wrong.
Yeah, it's something that I had no idea that all of this plastic was ending up in the oceans. When you see some of the footage, I mean, it's heart-wrenching. You're absolutely right. And I think what's so important about our film is that it will create an awareness about our use of plastic and how we have no idea how much of it is becoming problems, specifically for animals. So what we're trying to do with the film is just to try to create an awareness about just disposable plastic, kind of silly, stupid plastic that has only one use and then we throw it away, and to try to get people to realize that it really has an effect on other species and what we can do to decrease our use of plastic. So important.
Right, which we'll get to in a moment because that's very important. Why is all this plastic ending up in the ocean in the first place? Why isn't it going into a dump, a landfill?
Well, a lot of times trash ends up getting blown into waterways, and then it ends up, the waterway, you know, ends up leading into the ocean. You know, most of the plastic in the ocean comes from a land-based source, whether it's through a hurricane or a storm or just the wind. A lot of trash blows out of landfills and ends up in oceans. It's not like it's all coming off of a boat or, you know, being thrown out of a plane or something like that.
Right.
Most of it does come from us on land.
Is there any way, I mean, I know it's a huge, huge area or set of areas, but is there any way to actually take it out of the oceans?
We're looking at something the size of Texas, and to try to go through that whole area by trawling and picking up plastic, it's an insurmountable task. No one has come up with a way that we could do that. The main thing is to try not to let any more trash, plastic, refuse get into the ocean. And that the way to do that is to try to decrease the amount of food containers and amount of trash that we create. That's the only way to do it, is to start by not creating as much trash.
We're talking to Judy Cohen, executive producer of the documentary Bag It. So this is a very important point, which is that in our daily lives, and Jeb, who's a very amiable, funny guy, whom we see in the whole entire film, is talking about once he starts to become aware of plastic, he sees it everywhere, he sees how much he uses it. And indeed, I was watching this film yesterday, and then I went into my bathroom and was suddenly aware of the Listerine bottle and the deodorant bottle and all these bottles, and then the plastic wrapping, the things that I use come in. I mean, everything comes in plastic wrapping. It's such a daunting task to even imagine cutting down on that. And yeah, you take your tote bag to the store and you can order those little, I didn't even know about these until I saw them in the film, but these little baggies that are kind of cloth mesh bags or something that you can put your bulk produce in and stuff like that. But still, there's so much more disposable plastic. What are we supposed to do about it?
You know, I find that the most amount of plastic, my husband and I, we really decrease the amount of plastic that we have in our house and try not to buy as much. But, you know, things like, oh, I'm going to go buy some cheese, or I'm going to go buy, pretty much all food is in a plastic wrapper. And that's the thing that I find is the most amount of plastic that I put into our trash can. It's, you know, wrappers for food and plastic containers for food. So what I think people need to start thinking about is going to the deli and getting your cheese cut off and then have them wrap it in. Sometimes they wrap it in paper, or you can also bring your own containers. You know, processed food is really the biggest producer of plastic packaging, and that's something that you have to try not to buy as much of it. If you do that, then you can decrease your plastic. We actually don't buy shampoo in bottles anymore. We get shampoo bars, and you can buy shampoo bar soap. So when you really start thinking about it, and there's a lot of different websites out there where you can go to that'll help you think of ways to decrease, you know, buying things in plastic, you know, trying to buy in bulk and trying to use products that aren't in plastic or buy something in glass because you know that maybe that's going to get recycled more readily. But we are in a culture of plastic packaging. We have everything. You look around and it's like you can't almost not even go to the store unless you're just going to buy vegetables. But sometimes the vegetables are even wrapped in plastic. I mean, it's we have to, on a national level, you know, and a global level, we have to figure out ways not to package everything in plastic.
What do you think, I mean, I don't know if you've run the numbers on this, but what do you think is the potential of what we might call human voluntary habit change? I mean, when you look at the kinds of people that you have in Aspen and Telluride and Santa Fe and places where there's already a kind of green ecological awareness, that's one thing. But when you look at the whole nation, how much do you think we can cut down without legal and policy intervention?
You know, that is such a good point and a good question. I think that, you know, we're a culture of convenience. We do things because they're fast and they're easy, and we're in such a rush society that, of course, we're going to buy things in plastic, and it's really going to be hard to do without some kind of legislation. And a lot of people have, a lot of communities around the country are passing plastic bag bans, and that's just the very tip of the iceberg. You know, if your community stops, if the grocery stores stop just giving out free plastic bags, it will create some sense of awareness in individuals. We've seen it here in our community and a lot of other communities around the country. It's going to take, it's an enormous effort. It's going to take it something that at the national level to really create some kind of change. But, you know, we're trying to create at least a small awareness and have it trickle down because, you know, sometimes one person at a time is going to make some difference. But to really make a dent in the plastic packaging issue, it may take some kind of national legislation. I don't know.
Well, that's something that you show in the film that I guess happened in Ireland. They, I don't know if it was a nationwide or a town or a county or whatever, but they banned plastic bags. They didn't ban them. They just started charging for them. And the use just dropped by something like 80%.
Right. And that's what they found in communities around the world. And that's a great example in Ireland. The whole entire country, it wasn't a ban, you're right, it was a fee. You had to pay like 25 cents to use a plastic bag. And if people who would go to the store, of course, they're not going to pay 25 cents for a bag. So overnight, it had such an effect. It was over a 90% reduction in the use of plastic bags. In other words, people just wouldn't take them at the supermarket. So, you know, here in our town of Telluride, we passed a plastic bag ban in our grocery stores last year, and that means that you can't even get a plastic bag at the store. You can pay 10 cents and use a paper bag. But what it's done is really decrease the amount of plastic bags that people are using. You know, and I think that will help people think about other kinds of plastic in their own lives when they say, wow. We think that you really need legislation to actually create some change, even on a very minor scale.
Now, let's talk about the other places in the world where they've been banned and why.
Well, so take Bangladesh, for instance. Bangladesh, very poor country, they had these very, you know, those really super thin disposable plastic bags. They have them everywhere. You can, anything you buy, they'd put it in a little plastic bag. And they were having a real problem with their storm drains. The plastic bags were getting just thrown in the street. They were clogging their storm drains. And when they had floods a couple of years ago, the plastic bags were clogging the storm drains, and it became a national crisis. And that's when they said, we have got to ban these very thin, well, any kind of plastic bag. So they were one of the first countries to instill the plastic bag ban.
Now, in the United States, when cities, Seattle, for example, try to ban plastic bags, they get a lot of pushback, and it brings up the story, which is the continual repeated story of the United in the United States, which is corporations basically controlling our democracy. Give us an example. Like, tell us what happened in Seattle.
Well, Seattle, since the film has come out, actually, they have passed a bag ban, which is great. But when we made the film, the city of Seattle, there were a lot of residents who came forward to create, they wanted to stop the use of plastic bags in the city. And so they got a motion on the ballot and really pushed for plastic bag ban. And what happened was the American Chemistry Council, which is a group of chemical companies around the country, lobbied extremely hard. They put in a couple $1 million into the campaign to fight the bag ban in Seattle. And the reason they did that is because if there is a decrease in the production of plastic bags, then of course these companies that make the bags, you know, they make less money. So once again, it's all about money. You know, instead of looking at, well, let's see what we could do to create other sources of revenue that might be more green, instead of looking at creating, you know, the kinds of bags that would be more environmental, they put a bunch of money into it. The bag ban failed in Seattle, and it was a very close vote, but they did fail. And it was just really sad because the corporations that were fighting the bag ban were all, the American Chemistry Council, it was all about their bottom line. It was all about them wanting to make more money and not really caring about the consequences of plastic bags in the environment.
Which are really, really huge. I mean, they affect people as well as marine life and all of that. There was quite an amazing scene in which, and this gets into not only plastic bags, but plastic in general, and the plastic that's found in products and so on, where our hero, Jeb Barrier, decides that he's going to use lotions and shampoos and products for babies. It turns out his wife is expecting a baby. And use air freshener and microwave things in plastic containers and drink bottled water and all that stuff. What happens?
Well, it turns out that what happens when you put food in a plastic container, depending on the kind of plastic container it is, the chemicals in the plastic can actually leach into the food. And that's one situation where you have, you know, a real health hazard. The other situation is that some of the chemicals used in making plastic are also used in certain kinds of personal care products, like the fragrances that you have in shampoos or deodorant or lotion. Some of the chemicals in plastic, and they're getting a lot of airplay right now, phthalates and bisphenol A, specifically phthalates are used in fragrances in lotions. So when you're putting on, you know, a really lovely, expensive lotion, and it happens to have, if you read the ingredients, it happens to have the word fragrance on it, it doesn't say what that fragrance is made of. And that fragrance is made of some of the same family of chemicals, the phthalate family, that are used in plastic. So we sort of made a connection between chemicals that are in plastic, chemicals that are used in personal care products. There's no organization that is actually taking a close look and limiting companies using some of these chemicals. And that's a real problem. When some of these chemicals haven't been tested properly, we look at our government and the FDA and some of the governmental entities that approve these chemicals, there hasn't been enough scientific studies done on some of these. And so what's happening is the chemical companies are just using these chemicals very loosely, and we're not given the information as consumers about the fact that they are hazards to our health. It's very different in Europe. In Europe, a chemical is guilty until proven innocent. There are very, very strict regulations in European countries about using chemicals. In the United States, you can use a chemical, it's innocent until proven guilty. And so it's a totally different way of how our governments work. So sad, and you get very frustrated as a consumer thinking, my government would never, you know, allow a cancer-causing chemical to be in my shampoo, would they? But actually, the truth is, they do.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. We're talking to Judy Cohen about the documentary Bag It, which will be screened tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Farmers Market. Let's talk about that. What are the health hazards that are caused by the kind of plastics that are in plastic bags, plastic bottles, plastic containers, personal care products, lotions, and so on?
Well, there's something called bisphenol A, otherwise known as BPA. It's been getting a lot of press over the last few years. This is a chemical that is used in plastic to make it either soft or hard. And this is a chemical that is called an endocrine disruptor. And what that means is that what bisphenol A can do is it can alter the hormones in our body and create very serious health issues. Specifically, we found that, you know, bisphenol A is very dangerous for mothers who are in childbearing age because it gets passed on to the child. For instance, in Canada, they've totally outlawed bisphenol A. It's a chemical that's not being used in the country. And in the United States, it's very controversial. There, again, it's the chemical companies lobbying to allow this chemical to be used because they're saying, oh, there isn't enough scientific study.
But the studies are, in fact, there.
Well, yeah, they're absolutely there. And our government, our congressmen and congresswomen are being lobbied by these chemical companies to allow the chemicals to continue to be used, even though there's overwhelming evidence that they are causing health hazards.
So let's talk about how other countries do it. I mean, you talked about Europe having different kinds of laws. Chemicals have to be tested for their safety before they're put into anything, unlike here. But there's also some other things going on. There is, instead of when products are made, instead of a cradle-to-grave concept for a particular product that goes onto the market, there's something that's called a cradle-to-cradle concept. What is that?
That is where you have an idea for a product, and when you make it, all the materials that you use, you make it so that they can be reused, recycled, so that it's not just something that you throw away at the end. There's actually becomes another use for it at the end of that life. So it goes back to either can be totally decomposed and composted into what it originally was created by, or it can be completely reused into something so that it continues to have a life, so that there's no end life of the product. The end life is always is another life. It becomes another product or it has another use.
And so what does that actually look like? Let's say, I mean, they have plastic bottles for juice or whatever they're drinking.
Well, and in Germany, which is the example we use in the film, they have plastic Coke bottles, and they have little marks on the bottom of the bottle so that instead of sending that plastic bottle to the recycling facility, it's cleaned out, it's reused. It's reused and again, and Coca-Cola is put back into it. You know, the problem with recycling is that you could say that, you know, plastic could be a cradle-to-cradle product if it's reformatted into something else that gets used. Now, the problem with plastic recycling in our country is that the statistics are that less than 10% of all plastic is actually recycled. So if the plastic were actually getting recycled into another product, you know, we all hear about how plastic is made into plastic lawn chairs and, you know, plastic bottles can be made into clothing and all of these other products, which would be more of a cradle-to-cradle idea. But less than 10% of our plastic is actually getting recycled, and that, you know, there's the problem. But cradle to cradle, that idea is more about design. So when you go to design something like a ballpoint pen, when it runs out, what happens? Well, we throw it in the trash. If we were thinking more about every single thing that we make in this country, it always has another use after, or it can be made into another use. It can be used as something else. And that's just a whole philosophy. The Europeans are a little more progressive than we are on that level. We've just become such a disposable society that, oh, you know, my phone broke. I guess I'll just throw it away and get another one. You know, at some point, we have to stop doing that.
Right. And they've got a lot less space to work with than we do.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's talk about, I mean, this is something that you don't really cover in your film, but it's kind of the big question. Has anybody come up with something that is functionally plastic but actually biodegradable?
Well, okay, so that we didn't really go into the whole compostable, biodegradable issue in the film because it's a whole, we should make another film about that.
Yeah.
Plastic that is compostable is made from corn, and there's a whole lot of issues with, you know, using food to make products that aren't edible. That's one little issue. But the issue with compostable plastic is that it has to be composted in a facility. So there's not one composting facility in the state of Colorado right now. And so if I'm using, for instance, you can buy those compostable cups and silverware, and then you think, oh, great, it's compostable. I'll throw it in with the in my compost pile. Well, if you ever try to do that, you'll find out that those products actually don't decompose. They don't biodegrade. Even a year later, we tried it in our compost pile. It doesn't happen because it doesn't get hot enough. So in San Francisco, which is very progressive in terms of California's, you know, very progressive in terms of biodegradable compostable, they actually have biodegradable compostable composting facilities, and so you have to put the compostable plastic in a separate trash bin that then gets taken to the composting facility and gets composted. You need to have, it has to be really hot. You have to have it, it has to be
right.
At a high heat level for it to actually compost.
Well, what about something that doesn't have to be at a high heat level? I mean, we're an ingenious nation. Why can't we come up with a plastic bag that 3 years later turns into fish food?
You know, this is a great question. Why can't we? I mean, we have so many smart people. Why isn't there? Okay, you go to the grocery store and you buy this biodegradable plastic bag. So you buy that and you think, oh, I'm going to put my trash in it and I'll take that to the dumpster. But then it goes to a landfill and then it's, you know, hermetically sealed, or there's not enough oxygen there, there's not enough heat, it never biodegrades. So as far as I know, there's not a product out there that's really compostable outside of a compost facility.
Well, maybe that's a new project for the American Chemical Council. They wouldn't even be interviewed for the film.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they wouldn't. It seems crazy. I mean, we have fantastic scientists. Why can't, you know, the reason is that it's so easy. It seems so easy and cheap to make a plastic bag, but they don't include, you know, sort of the environmental cost of all these things. And, you know, I've noticed that a lot of juice that used to come in glass containers is now they're selling it now in plastic containers. And that's because it's cheaper to transport. Of course, you know, a case of orange juice in a plastic bottle is less expensive to transport because it's not as heavy as a case of orange juice in glass bottles. So if anything, our country is moving even more into creating plastic packaging than away from it.
Well, a lot of work left to do. Now, this documentary came out, a couple of years ago. Have you had a lot of people seen it? I mean, it seems like something that everybody who votes in our democracy should be required to see.
Yeah. Well, the film it's been doing incredibly well. It's traveled all over the world. It's been playing on public television for the past year. A lot of local stations around the country have aired it. And we now have it playing in colleges and high schools around the country. So it's continuing to have a life way beyond its release date, which is great. We had no idea that actually the film would be so popular. But, you know, documentary films, when you think about popular documentary films that everybody knows about and everyone has seen, you know, you're going to name probably, you know, Michael Moore's films. You know, Fahrenheit 9/11 and many of his films actually made it really well at the box office. Now, smaller documentary films like Bagot and other films like ours that have really important messages and that, you know, are just as good as like a Hollywood blockbuster, somehow people are not drawn to these kinds of movies as much because they go to the movies to be entertained. So, you know, I think that Bagot is getting out there on the grassroots level really well, and it's actually being released on Netflix this month. So,
oh, great.
Yeah, people will be able to get it on Netflix and Amazon, and it's going to be on the documentary channel for, it's going to run on the documentary channel for the next year, and it may go back on public television after that. So, but gosh, you know, I think people who see the movie and are really moved by it, which is a lot of people, they'll buy the DVD, they'll pass it on to their friends, and, you know, I guess the message is getting out there, but certainly not at the level of, like, you know, a blockbuster film.
Right.
You know? Like,
well, yeah, and I'm sure it's seen most in places like Santa Fe and Aspen and Telluride and these other places where people already kind of get it. But it's a terrific film, and it's really funny and fun to watch in a lot of ways, too, even as it's very serious. So I hope people go tomorrow night at the Santa Fe Farmers Market here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It's at the Santa Fe Farmers Market Pavilion at 7 o'clock. Judy Cohen is executive producer of this documentary, which is called Bagot. And I suppose if anybody misses it, they can order it on their Netflix or go to the website, and the website is realthing.us, R-E-E-L, thing.us. Judy, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Mira Crean. She is the founder and director of Pomegranate Studios, and tonight and then this weekend is Invaders of the Heart 2012. Welcome, Mira.
Thank you so much for fitting me in. I really appreciate it.
I love it. I love that you're back, and I love what you're doing. I mean, it's belly dancing, and you're working with a particular musical group that is coming into Santa Fe today, and they're going
yes.
to be, where are they going to be tonight?
Actually, they're going to be at Vanessi.
Okay.
Yes.
And they are called?
Beatbox Guitar.
Beatbox Guitar.
They're a duo that I met in Florida. Last year, I took 20 of my dancers to this extraordinary event out in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And there were dancers there performing and teaching literally from all over the world. It was a five-day event. And there were people there from China, Korea, Japan, Russia, the Netherlands, Germany, you name it, Brazil. I mean, all over the world that came to belly dance, and they all specialize in different styles of belly dance. Most people don't know this, but belly dance has just taken off into this huge thing that's done all over the world now, and in many, 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 many different ways. It's become just sort of this melting pot for incredible exploration of fusion and different kinds of expression. And so I saw Beatbox Guitar there. They're a duo out of New York. He's obviously a beatboxer, and Rob is this fabulous guitarist who does a lot of flamenco guitar and actually has been to Santa Fe many times, loves it here. And I just enjoyed working with them so much, and I loved their music. I particularly have brought to my field a certain kind of fusion called belly baile, which is a fusion style that incorporates different styles of belly dance along with tango, flamenco, and that kind of thing. And I thought immediately that these gentlemen would be wonderful to choreograph to and just fabulous to have out here. So they're going to do a concert tonight at Vanessi at 7:30, no cover. It's free, and anyone can come hear their music. And then on Friday and Saturday night, we're going to do a big show with them. We're going to take to the James A. Little stage at 7 o'clock, and we're going to do a full-on incredible show with them. We have all different kinds of genres of belly dance represented, and then a big set with them, original choreography to their music. And 90 costumes, 20 dancers. It's just going to be an extravaganza.
An extravaganza. Now, I find it fascinating what you just said a moment ago, that belly dancing has become a worldwide phenomenon, and everybody is bringing a different style to it. So, I mean, Does American belly dancing, like what you do, for example, have an American feel to it? Does Brazilian belly dancing have a Brazilian...
Does. Yeah, it most certainly does. It's actually just so amazing that way. And I feel like, you know, all art, any artist of any form will say art is born out of its environment. So the American style of belly dance is very particular. And I think, you know, you can really see our culture reflected in it. We do a style that in our world is called pop and lock. And there's just a tremendous amount of precise movement that happens very quickly all over the body. This is not something you would ever see performed in Egypt. Egyptian dancers do not dance this way at all. But in America, when we've taken it on, we've sort of, sort of transformed over many years and become this style of dance where there's a lot of this kind of movement in it. And I see that as a direct influence of the kind of environments in which we live.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, if you look at MTV has really changed, for instance, America's attention span. You know, like we think of things coming at us very quickly. We want things to, you know, we're excited. We are also a country of innovators. We like things of innovation. You know, so it's not surprising to me that, you know, America has done a lot of the leading work in innovating the form of belly dance and the different styles of belly dance. So, yeah, we're innovators. We are constantly bombarded by a lot of different, visual input. And so we give that back out as dancers.
Very interesting. I had one of those moments that changes the way you see once when I was in my 20s and I was living in Boston and had saw an American dancer doing Indian dance. Mm-hmm. And she did it perfectly. You could tell that she'd studied in India and she had all the moves right, and yet it didn't look real.
Right.
And I thought, what's going on there? She's doing it exactly right. What is this? And I realized that in dance, or I guess in any art form, if you don't make it your own culturally, mm-hmm. and integrate the movements that you were born with or the way mm-hmm. of seeing and feeling that you were born with, mm-hmm. it's imitation.
Right. And I talk about that a lot in my classes. I talk about authenticity. What does it mean to be authentic and to bring yourselves, you know, to it? And sometimes I'll have a student who really looks very Arabic and does that sort of Egyptian style very naturally, flows out of her in a very natural way. But if it doesn't flow out of you in a natural way, then you need to make the movement your own. And you do need, so that there is an authenticity to it. I mean, dance is supposed to convey, technique is fine. Technique is great, but that's just there for the dancer to have something to say. There has to be content there. And so in order for that to come out, there has to be a real authenticity, and there has to be a sense of what it is you have to say and why you've been attracted to a particular dance form. I think this is very important, you know, and as an actual practitioner, you know, and an artist, you have to ask yourself those questions, like why? Why is it this dance form that I'm drawn to, and what is it through this particular language through the body that I'm here to express?
And the answers to those questions might take a lifetime
to really... You hope they take a whole lifetime.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
So we're talking to Mira Crean of Pomegranate Studios, and this big event is happening this week. And before we went on the air, you were telling me about how a lot of people have stereotypes about belly dancers.
Yeah, it's pretty major. I mean, you know, it's so funny. Like, you go to the ballet, and people have hardly anything on anymore, and, you know, they're lifting their legs above their heads, and nobody ever asks, you know, isn't that too sexual for my daughter to do? But if they come and do belly dancing, you know, suddenly these questions become very important, and it becomes almost, you know, I feel sometimes confronted by the fact that just by being a belly dancer, it's almost a sexual, a political statement, you know, because it brings up sexual politics. And all of a sudden, people start, you know, down that road. And it's so fascinating to me because, you know, I don't really see it that way. I mean, not to say that it's not sexy. I'm not trying to say that at all. But the way in which I have, inhabited the dance and the dance has inhabited me has been a very different kind of journey. And the women that were first involved in this, that really attracted me to it as a young child were all intellectuals and adventurers, and they were all anthropologists and people who were studying culture and interested in a world view, and they were all just these amazing, strong, powerful mentors, you know. And so I feel like, you know, that's how I feel about it, you know, and I use it as a tool, as a platform for self-discovery, in a way for women to claim their femininity, you know, And yet still their power and their strength, and, you know, find a deeper relationship with their bodies physically, a way that they can still be very feminine in themselves, but absolutely, again, authentic to who they are. You know, it's not about, you know, dancing for someone else. It's about dancing for yourself, about dancing for your joy.
And, well, and of course it's about dancing for somebody else, because we're community. We're all in this together. We're all interacting. It's a form of communication.
It is a form of communication. And if you're a performer, I guess what I meant by that is not about, it's not about dancing for someone else. If you're a performer, of course you're dancing for someone else. I just meant it's not a come on, you know. It's not like, you know, it's not an invitation in that way.
Well, and the kind of attitudes that, I guess, the way you describe people coming to you with this, like, is this sexual, implies a whole context in which sexuality is taboo, and there's a kind of Puritan embedded in that, Puritanism embedded in that question, as opposed to Eros infuses all art all the time.
And that's my
ladies
answer.
And gentlemen.
Exactly, ladies and gentlemen, right. Where do we think our, you know, the seat of our creativity and our life force emanates from? You know, it begins there and grows outward and upward from there, you know. And so I feel like, you know, all of these things are very natural and inclusive. That's, you know, it's the biology of life. This is how we all come into being, you know. And I think our sort of right relationship to that, you know, is then an expression or a celebration of the joy of being alive, being human, being in the body.
Now, you are doing this, you and your dancers are doing this performance, it's called, every year it's called Invaders of the Heart, and this year the subtitle is Rapture.
Yeah.
And you've got all kinds of different, I mean, speaking of bringing a kind of American expression into it. What is, you were telling me you've got all kinds of different looking pieces in this evening.
So in the very beginning, we're going to start in a very traditional way. We're going to start from Egypt, and we're going to move into Turkey and do a Sufi piece. And then we're going actually to India. And so this will be all very traditional dance. And then I'm going to come out and do something completely fusion-oriented. I'm going to actually dance to a Bjork song. And one of the fun, some of the fun things in the show, besides the beatbox, of course, which is sort of the, you know, the main body of the show, which is a flamenco fusion piece, are a steampunk set, and also a very fun set at the end where we all became superheroes, and we have, you know, villains, and we have, you know, all like real superheroes from the comics, you know. So everybody's a particular, like, I'm Emma Frost, everybody's a particular one. And anyway, it's just a fun idea. I used to always tease everybody and say how I'm a secret agent superhero belly dancer, and so they said, can we do a set? And I said, well, sure, why not? And it's been so much fun to build.
Very interesting. I think all girls at some point should get their superhero names and their superhero identities and bring them forward.
Well, you know what I want to do actually with this whole idea is someday when I quote-unquote retire, I would like to write a series for children of stories about this dance company. And the women, you know, all have very real backgrounds, very real body types, very real issues. But they also have superhero powers, and they have superhero gadgets. Like, you know, the little nose ring is really a camera, and the, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, they work for the UN, and they solve mysteries and problems, kind of like Scooby-Doo all over the world, you know. And but they have problems amongst themselves, things they have to work out, you know, issues that need to be resolved. And I think it would be a really fun teaching tool for young girls.
Mira Crean is founder and director of Pomegranate Studios. For more information, you can go to pomegranatestudio.org, and you can call 505-986-6164. Invaders of the Heart is Friday and Saturday at 7 in the evening at the James A. Little Theater on Cerrillos Road in the New Mexico School for the Deaf. And you can just show up. You can get tickets at the door if you like. And you also have beatbox guitar playing tonight at Vanessi.
at Vanessi at 7:30, no cover. And there are also workshops. I should say there's a beatboxing workshop. There is a flamenco compas workshop with the guitarist. There are going to be two workshops, a drum solo workshop and a dancing to lyrical music that are all improv workshops. So it's just going to be fun.
Excellent.
Absolute fun.
Let's go out now with music from Beatbox Guitar.